This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated September 10th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front cover, top of the fold, at Implus, insoles are made for growing, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Durham. Implus Foot Care, a maker of foot products including the Soft Sole brand of shoe inserts, is growing again after having doubled its workforce over the past 2 years. A year to the month after moving into its newly built 260,000-square-foot headquarters and warehouse building on T.W. Alexander Drive, the company has contracted with its landlord, the Keith Corporation of Charlotte, to add 50,000 square feet to the eastern side of the $13 million building. Implus President Todd Vohr says acquisitions of brands and a resulting expansion of the company's catalog of shoe accessories and outdoor navigational tools has rendered inadequate the building's storage capacity. Though we originally built in plenty of extra space, we filled it much quicker than anticipated, Vohr says. The company's workforce now stands at 215, all but 15 of whom are based in Durham. Vohr says global sales for Implus products were about $111 million in 2009, and he is projecting sales of $140 million in 2010. In November, Implus expanded beyond its core footwear products of insoles, shoelaces, and deodorizers and acquired Fletcher, North Carolina-based High Gear, which sells performance watches, navigation tools, and other accessories for outdoor enthusiasts. In August, Implus expanded its reach into Europe with the acquisition of French company Eurosphere Anticipation. Eurosphere already was a distributor of Implus products in Europe. Vohr says the company's focus over the next year will be in product development and expansion of its current line of products rather than making acquisitions. While we are always looking for a great opportunity, we seek to outperform in all market channels with every brand in the Implus arsenal, he says. The company began direct-to-consumer web sales in 2008, but most of its sales are still through a network of retailers worldwide. Its products are carried by national and local retailers, including Finish Line, Rackroom Shoes, Walmart, Target, and Walgreens. Sid Cardoso, Jr., owner of the Inside Out Sports Stores in Cary and in Charlotte, says he has been carrying Implus Soft Sole shoe insert products for many years. We have different brands we carry, and at the end of the year, we put together a report. We stick with the most successful brands or change. They are one of the most successful ones we carry, he says of the soft soles. Implus has one of its soft sole FitSen foot scanner machines at Inside Out. The machine makes a computer scan of a customer's foot and recommends which soft sole product would provide the most stability and comfort. Customers like to use this machine because it is very visual, Cardoso says. It's one thing for me to say you have fairly flat arches, but it's another thing to see it on the screen. It's a pretty good selling tool. Ken Bewley, Director of Development for the Keith Corporation, says construction work at the site will begin within a couple of months. Still above the fold, Carolina's number one. With 90.3% of grads passing bar exam, UNC takes top spot from Campbell, by Chris Basden. From Raleigh, Brian Sullivan recently got the news he'd worked for years to hear. He'd passed the North Carolina bar exam. I think it's a very exciting thing, says Sullivan, a recent UNC Chapel Hill Law School graduate who began work as an associate at Wyrick Robbins in Raleigh after passing the arduous test. Part of its excitement, part of its relief, he says. Sullivan was one of 144 UNC Law School graduates to take the test in July. 130 of those passed the exam, or 90.3%, good enough to give UNC the highest bar passage rate among the state's seven law schools. Having the top bar exam passage rate is seen as a feather in the cap for a law school and a selling point for prospective students. In addition to all the training they provide in regular classes, schools typically offer voluntary programs to help students prepare for the exam. While taking the top bar passage rate is a cause for celebration, and posting disappointing results inevitably leads to hand-wringing. Many factors other than the general quality of legal education come into play for the winning prize. Some schools, such as Duke University, have a small number of former students taking the exam, which means that just a few students failing can have a huge impact on the school's overall percentage results. Changes in the exam questions also can affect scores from year to year, as can a school's dedication to teaching to the test. And no matter the school involved, some years may simply feature a class that's inordinately stronger or weaker than those that came before it. With this year's results, UNC takes over the top spot from Campbell University, which posted a 90.7% passage rate in 2009. We are very pleased for our UNC law graduates who successfully passed the July 2010 North Carolina Bar Exam, Dean Jack Boger says in an email statement. Campbell's grads traditionally do very well on the exam and are known for besting the better-known schools in the state. But Campbell's passage rate slipped to 83% this year, with 78 out of 94 passing. That was good enough only for third place. Duke University clocked in at number 2 with 83.3% passage rate. Just 30 Duke law graduates took the exam, or about 15% of the graduating class. Most of Duke's graduates go out of state to practice law, with New York typically being the top choice. Tia Barnes, Duke's Assistant Dean for Academic Affairs, says the school has offered additional upper-level writing training for years. While the top three spots went to Triangle Schools, the area's fourth law school and North Carolina Central was unable to perform nearly as well. The Durham School, which long has been known as one of the best legal education bargains in the country, had just 96 of 145 graduates pass the exam, or 66.2% last in the state. Dean Raymond Pierce has been expanding the size of the school, and he says that absorbing additional students has had an impact on the bar passage rate. He says, "We were really disappointed in our performance this year, but we have every reason to believe that we will improve next year. It is not a representation of the strength and quality of our legal education, and we will rebound." In all, 740 of the 1,014 students taking the exam passed, a passage rate of nearly 73%. The numbers include both first-time takers as well as the vast majority, as well as repeaters. The two-day test features a multiple-choice section on U.S. law as well as the essay section on North Carolina law. The exam is administered by the North Carolina Board of Law Examiners twice a year, but the July version typically draws many more takers than the February offering. Still on the front page, local hospitals project revenue growth of 30%, by James Gallagher, from Raleigh. The Triangle's hospitals are expecting their net patient revenues to climb by 30% to a cumulative total of more than $5.5 billion over the next four fiscal years. The growth is significant, as hospitals generally account for about a third of all health care spending. The revenue surge is largely the result of a growing and aging population, health officials say. However, expanded services, new facilities, health care reform, and acquired physician practices are also adding to the mix. When you've got 100 people a day moving into the county, they're going to need health care, says Bernadette Spong, Rex Healthcare's chief financial officer, adding that the hospital is seeing more patients and older people who need more care associated with age, and, she says, increased diagnosis of cancer are driving demand for cancer cure. According to documents filed with the state, Rex projects that its net patient revenue for the fiscal year 2014 will exceed $708 million, up by 28.2% from its projected fiscal 2010 year-end review. Rex's fiscal year ends June 30. Net patient revenue is the actual money hospitals receive for care. Rex, like other hospitals in the area, is developing a cancer care center. The hospital intends to begin construction in late 2011 on a $60 million center that will significantly increase its ability to treat cancer patients. Rex also is planning a $132 million in renovations and additions at its main hospital, as well as construction of a $115 million outpatient center. Such additions are a major driver in projected health revenue growth, says George Pink, a health finance professor in UNC Charlotte Hill, UNC Chapel Hill's Gillings School of Global Public Health. Each hospital in the Triangle has expansion plans and presumably revenue and cash flow, he says. Duke University Health System, which is expecting its revenue to exceed $2.6 billion come fiscal 2014, up from just under $2 billion in fiscal 2010, is in the process of adding more than $700 million worth of facilities, including a patient tower and a cancer hospital. The cancer center is expected to open in 2012, while the patient tower is scheduled to open in 2013. UNC Hospitals had projected that a new Hillsborough Hospital, which was to open in 2014, would produce a major bump in revenue, pushing its take to nearly $1.2 billion in fiscal 2014, up from nearly $891 million in fiscal 2010. But those numbers aren't likely to happen now, says Chris Ellington, UNC Hospital's CFO. The Hillsborough Hospital, which was factored into those projections, won't open until 2015, he says. Still, UNC will benefit from a new imaging center currently under construction on NC-54 and a new ambulatory surgical center that opened on the hospital's main campus. The revenue gains do not mean that the hospitals will be swimming in cash. New facilities required continued or increased capital expenditures as well as additional staff. Ellington says UNC hospitals plan to hire 350 staff members this year as a result of its new facilities. The hospitals actually project total expenses to grow faster than their revenue, with the expenses cumulatively to grow 30.9% to $5.5 billion. Once all things are settled, the hospitals each will turn small profits ranging from $32.3 million for WickMed Health and Hospitals in 2014 to $196.4 million for Duke. Additionally, hospitals expect to see their revenues improve during the next 4 years as the Federal Health Reform Act is implemented. Many previously uninsured patients will be covered either through commercial insurance or expanded Medicaid benefits. Still on the front page and below the fold, state swaps plunge agencies in dismal swamp of $25 million in losses. By Lee Weisberger. Raleigh. Three big state government units, enamored with the prospect of cutting borrowing costs through the use of interest rate swaps between 2003 and 2006, are staring at losses of as much as $25 million on the sophisticated but risky financial transactions. The University of North Carolina system and UNC hospitals, as of June 30, 2009, were facing paper losses totaling $10.8 million and $9.22 million, respectively. Separately, the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency, as of the same date, was staring at a loss of $5.7 million, according to state documents. The swaps headed south as the financial crisis pushed interest rate across the board to rock-bottom levels. The paper losses now faced by the three agencies would become real if the agencies attempted to cash out of the swaps while interest rates remained low. Or they could decide to hold them until interest rates start to recover, says Amy Resnick, editor of New York-based Bond Buyer magazine. In a separate transaction, the state recently answered that question by refinancing some $499 million in bonds to rid itself of two swaps that had a negative fair value of $34.7 million. As for the trio of agencies, their swaps worked in basically the same fashion. All three had gone to the market offering millions in variable rate bonds to investors, meaning their borrowing costs could rise if interest rates went up. To fix the rate they would have to pay, they turned to a large bank as their partner in the swamp. Under the deals, the agencies agreed to pay their partners at a fixed rate interest, ranging from 3.31% to 3.81% in return for a stream of cash ranging from 63% to 67% of LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, an averaged interest rate measured used as a benchmark in financial transactions worldwide. Since the financial meltdown in 2008, however, the LIBOR has sometimes clocked in at all-time lows as financial managers attempted to stimulate the economy. One of the effects was to swing the swap deals to the agency's disadvantage, leaving them paying out more than the return cash stream was bringing in. UNC spokesman Brian T. Smith confirmed the negative fair value on the university swap, which was made in 2006 with Wachovia Bank as the university's swap partner. Asked whether UNC is considering cashing out and taking a loss, Smith said, "At this point in time, the university does not have such plans." Housing Finance Authority Director Bob Kukab says the losses on his agency swaps hasn't risen to a magnitude at which he would be forced to exit the deal. The back-and-forth payments are close, he says, adding that over the life of the swap transactions, dating back to 2003 and 2004, the authority has been able to pass lower borrowing costs on to clients in the form of lower mortgage rates. "And that's why we did the swaps in the first place," he says. Next article, UNC in a Change of Direction, by James Gallagher, from Chapel Hill. Leaders of UNC Chapel Hill believe they've found a way to kickstart development of their Carolina North satellite campus by making the first building a revenue-producing one that would pay its own way. The university is developing plans for a research building in the range of 175,000 square feet that would house university-related research units that currently are renting space off campus. The rent they are paying now would go to the university to pay down the debt taken out to construct the research building, says Jack Evans, executive director of Carolina North. As a result, the project would be self-liquidating. Brian Runberg, UNC's Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities and Planning, says design work on the building could begin as early as next year. The university would issue bonds to fund construction. The amount needed has not been determined, but such buildings typically run north of $80 million. Carolina North is envisioned as a 250-acre campus with a mix of corporate and academic research activities. Located about 2 miles north of UNC's main campus, it also would become home to UNC's School of Law. It is akin in concept to NC State University's successful Centennial Campus. The proposed UNC research facility, which would be located close to the Estates Drive side of the new campus, would be built first instead of an originally planned Innovation Center. Campus planners for years have been pointing to the Innovation Center, a place to house startup companies with ties to UNC research, as the cornerstone for the new campus. Then came the economic downturn, which killed that idea, says Evans. The Innovation Center was to be developed by a private company that would lease the land from the university. But private developers have struggled to gain financing in recent years. Additionally, a building to house startup companies, many of which could fail, is not very attractive to lenders. "The financials are such that it doesn't look like that will pan out," says Runberg. Officials have been working on planning and creating Carolina North for more than 10 years. The university has signed a development agreement with the town of Chapel Hill and has put out its first annual report, which notes that the only progress so far is the construction of an airplane hangar at RDU International Airport, which will serve as a replacement for facilities being lost at the Horace Williams Airport, which will be closed to make way for Carolina North. While campus officials say the economy has been the main roadblock in advancing the campus, they hope that getting the first building up would be the catalyst needed to get Carolina North moving. Officials at NC State say it wasn't until they had their first buildings up and running that Centennial Campus really started going. Charles Leffler, who at the time of Centennial Campus's planning was NCSU's Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities and Planning, and is now Vice Chancellor for Finance and Business, recalls the sequence of events. Subsequent to the opening of the campus's Research 1 building in the late 1980s and the construction of the College of Textiles building, then the sequence of buildings started, said Leffler. Next up, 4 Davis properties to be sold at auction, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh, 4 office buildings at Highwoods Office Center are headed for sale at a public auction on September 17th, barring a last-minute deal between investors with Craig Davis Properties and their New York lender. The buildings were bought in February 2007 near the peak of the commercial real estate investment bubble by veteran real estate investor Craig Davis of Cary. Like many others in the market, Davis has been fighting to salvage much of his portfolio of properties and development projects across the Triangle as leasing activity has languished. Davis and his partners with First Point Partners, LLC of New York, operating as FPDV 1 LLC, purchased the buildings from Highwoods Properties of Raleigh for $30.4 million. It was a reasonable figure at the time for a set of buildings valued at almost $35.8 million for Wake County property tax purposes. The buyer secured the deal with a loan worth up to $29 million from Column Financial Incorporated of New York, according to county deed records. Occupancy rates and tenants in the four buildings, which total 256,000 square feet, have shifted over the years, but the office park's occupancy rate has been relatively unchanged at 79% since the sale, according to Triangle Business Journal's space survey data. Should the public auction be held on September 17th, Highwoods would face the prospect of perhaps buying back the buildings. Highwoods Property President and CEO Ed Fritchett said his staff is constantly monitoring the activities of other landlords in the market. However, as a matter of routine, our policy is not to comment on rumors or speculation in the market regarding possible acquisition targets, he says. Davis's Highwoods Office Center buildings originally were developed by Highwoods Properties and are within view of the Real Estate Investment Trust headquarters in the Smoketree Tower building. The buildings were constructed between 1982 and 1999 as part of the 150-acre Highwoods Office Park between Atlantic Avenue and Capitol Boulevard. The portfolio includes the Global Building at 3200 Atlantic Avenue, the Magnolia Building at 3120 Highwoods Boulevard, the Red Oak Building at 3128 Highwoods Boulevard, and the Laurel Building at 3100 Highwoods Boulevard. A notice of foreclosure sale that was published in the East Wake News on September 8th states that FPDV1 LLC defaulted on its loan for the buildings. Barry Mann, a partner with the Manning Fulton Law Firm in Raleigh, has been assigned as substitute trustee for the transaction. Mann wouldn't comment on the pending sale. Neither Craig Davis nor First Point Partners executive Russ Sturgis returned calls for comment. Craig Davis Properties also is an investor and manager of the Durham Center Office Building in downtown Durham, Greenfield North Industrial Park in Garner, Globe Center Industrial Park in Morrisville, Park Center Office and Research Triangle Park, University Place Office Park in Durham, Venture Center Office Park at Centennial Campus in Raleigh, and the Raleigh Medical Center Building in West Raleigh, among other properties. The following article is titled, Former NC Investing Chief Starts Own Firm, by Lee Weisberger, from Durham. Patricia Garrick, former Chief Investment Officer for North Carolina's Public Pension System, has opened her own investment advisory business in Durham. Verde Asset Management, operating out of a Meridian Parkway office, was incorporated on May 20th, according to state filings. Garrick's partner is Wendell McCain, a co-founder of Chapel Hill-based Parish Capital, a private equity firm that has counted the state's $68 billion pension system as one of its major investors. McCain left Parish in late 2009 or early 2010. At Verity Asset, he and Garrick are offering outsourced investing advice to mid-sized pension plans and other institutional investors. Our goal is to construct an operating infrastructure that increases client access to global investment resources while reducing overall cost, says the company's website, which remains under development. Neither Garrick nor McCain returned phone messages seeking comment. The amount being managed by Verity at this point was not available. Charles Leedy, who operates Chapel Hill Investment Advisors and spent years on the investment staff of the UNC Chapel Hill Endowment, says the duo will have their work cut out for them in getting Verity off the ground. Leedy defines a mid-sized client as a pension plan or other institutional investor with about $100 million in assets to invest. There's a lot of competition out there in just that range, and the market is very tough right now, he says. To make it work, they're going to have to rely on a lot of contacts they may have made in the past. Alan Hughes of New York-based Black Enterprise magazine, which produces an annual ranking of the top minority-owned investment advisory firms, agrees. Not a whole lot of pension funds and other clients are looking to change their investments around right now. Garrick and McCain are both African-American. Garrick, then working for the Indiana pension system, was hired in 2004 by then North Carolina Treasurer Richard Moore. Initially making nearly $168,000, her salary had been increased to $340,000 by 2009 when she was replaced by Moore's successor in the Treasurer's office, Janet Cowell, in September 2009. McCain, a UNC Chapel Hill graduate and former vice president at Bank Boston Ventures, joined two other partners, Charles Merritt and James Mason, to form Parrish in 2004. The fund-to-fund investor in private equity and venture capital went on to grow total money under management to around $2.5 billion and to include such names as CalPERS, the California Pension System, among its list of clients. As of June 30, 2009, the North Carolina Pension System had $466 million committed to three Parrish funds. Merritt and Mason, the remaining Parrish partners of the original founding trio, have declined to discuss McCain's departure from the firm, and a Parrish spokeswoman said both were traveling the week of September 7. The next article will help you see red. North Carolina State University trails ACC League schools in spending per sport, by Chris Basden. From Raleigh. Not long after she became North Carolina State University's athletics director, Debbie Yao asked her staff to run a comparison showing how the Wolfpack's per-sport spending stacks up against that of its Atlantic Coast Conference competitors. The numbers were not encouraging. According to the comparison, which uses financial data the schools report to the federal government, NCSU spent an average of $2.3 million per sport in 2008-2009. Next to last in the 12-member ranking conference. The ranking was based on NCSU having total expenditures of $52.7 million and 23 sports. Florida State topped the list, spending an average of $3.8 million on its 19 sports. Locally, Duke University clocked in at fifth with $2.7 million per sport, while UNC Chapel Hill was sixth with $2.6 million per sport. Duke has 26 sports, UNC has 28. It's notoriously hard to get an apples-to-apples comparison of athletic department finances since schools use different accounting methods. Even so, the numbers prompt an important question. Should NCSU fans be worried about being so low on the list? Chad McAvoy, an associate professor of sports management at Illinois State University, thinks so. It's definitely something that I would be concerned about a little bit, he says. If they can't generate the revenue of some of their peer institutions, can they compete on the playing field long term? More money allows schools to hire better coaches, and athletics administrators have long argued that pricey facilities will help attract more talented recruits. NCSU Senior Associate Athletics Director David Horning agrees that the amount of money that's spent on a sports team can impact that team's wins and losses, and he says NCSU is looking at ways to improve its revenue generation. We've got to give our programs a chance to be successful, says Horning, who identifies several ways NCSU can increase its haul. One is a new media rights deal struck by the conference, which will boost revenue for all ACC schools in coming years. NCSU also is looking to generate more money from its licensing and sports marketing programs. Producing more wins on the gridiron and men's basketball court also would help sell more tickets. Looking at an average per sport expenditure number has its disadvantages. Schools typically spend much more on football and men's basketball than they do on other sports. And there's also a hierarchy among non-revenue sports, depending on tradition and other factors. Honestly, at every school, I would argue that the sports are tiered in some way, says Duke Associate Director of Athletics Mitch Moser. A number of factors impact how much a school spends on an individual sport, including the size of the team and staff, the equipment and facilities that are needed, and the travel requirements for both competitions and recruiting. Coaches' salaries, which are often determined by experience levels and win-loss records, also have a big impact. How do schools decide what to spend per sport each year? UNC Senior Associate Athletics Director Martina Ballin says that UNC typically starts with the current year's budget and then tells coaches to let administrators know if they need increases, and if so, why. We look at each request and then look at their justifications and try to figure out what needs to happen, she says. Not everybody thinks that bigger athletics budgets are a good idea. Katie Otto, an assistant professor of sports management at Western Carolina University, says there's sometimes a big difference between how academic facilities such as classrooms look compared to athletic facilities, and the students see what is being prioritized. It's definitely out of perspective, Otto says of athletic spending. It does send a message as to what you value and why. Next up, pace of restructures rising as banks avoid foreclosure. From Raleigh by Lee Westberger. Restructure rather than foreclose. That's the path Triangle banks have been taking more and more in recent months to deal with troubled loans. Over the past year, the volume of restructured loan deals on the books of 13 area banks has shot up by more than 600%, from $57 million in June 2009 to $404 million as of June 30, 2010. The numbers were pulled from data collected by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The federal watchdog agency doesn't require that banks publicly report the kind of loans they are restructuring, but as of March 2008, it began requiring them to include residential mortgage loans in the totals. The loan amounts represent modified loans in which the borrowers were current on their repayments as of the reporting date. Absolutely, we have been watching these restructuring numbers going up, says Matthew Jones of Charlotte-based Forum Capital, a real estate investment and brokerage firm. If it is feasible to restructure rather than foreclose, that's better for the banks. By restructuring, bankers are seeking to give borrowers more time to put their financial houses in order. The loan rewrites can be in either the amount of principal or interest due, and the bank records records an immediate hit on the devalued loan and includes it as non-performing asset in the report it submits to banking regulators. If the borrowers then go on to make their repayments according to the terms of the restructuring, the bankers, after an interval, are allowed to remove the loan from the non-performing category, says Steve Ogburn, CEO of Raleigh-based business lender Capstone Bank. But only if they are meeting the new terms, he says. Another benefit that comes to banks by restructuring is that they can set aside less in reserves on them than for other classes of troubled loans. The FDIC, expecting difficulties in the commercial real estate sector due to rising vacancies and unemployment, in October 2009 issued guidelines encouraging banks to shoot for loan restructurings, even if the values of the real estate underpinning the deals continued to decline. It is not known how much of the $404 million Triangle total as of June 30th were in the commercial real estate area. Such loan workouts are often easier said than done, says independent bank analyst Don Coker. That's really true when you are talking about these strip malls that have lost tenants, he says. The whole point of the restructuring is to match the rewritten loan payments to the amount of income the mall developer has coming in. And it's very difficult to get the payment low enough if a lot of the tenants have left and the income isn't there anymore. From this week's executive profile, Lynn Holmes, Chairman, Employment Security Commission of North Carolina. Applying Her Skills to Help Thousands of Unemployed by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh. 6 months into her new job as Chairman of the Employment Security Commission of North Carolina, Lynn Holmes finds herself having to be a calming force. Having never worked in state government, she is relying on her 22 years of management and lobbying experience at Bell South to help keep the agency, which assists more than 440,000 unemployed workers, mission-focused and looking to the future. She says, one thing that's been most surprising to me is I don't think I have run into an issue yet that I haven't seen before. Holmes, who was appointed to the SEC post in February by Governor Beverly Perdue, says she's not sure how she got on the governor's list of potential appointees. She's certain they met when Holmes was serving as a lobbyist for Bell South between 1990 and 1999, and Perdue was a state senator. Holmes contributed to Perdue's gubernatorial campaign in 2008, but she says the women don't know each other well. I'm sure there were other people he considered for this position, but I was available, she laughs. After retiring from Bell South in 2006, Holmes formed a consulting firm, Ross Holmes Group, LLC, to assist clients with ethics compliance issues and state lobbying work. In 2009, the North Carolina Cable Telecommunications Association, the state trade group that represents businesses in the cable communication industry, hired Holmes' company to represent its members. Brad Phillips, Vice President of Government and Public Affairs for Time Warner Cable in Raleigh and past President of the NCCTA, says the association's members wanted help at the General Assembly regarding pending legislation that would allow municipalities to begin offering cable, phone, and broadband services. With Lynn's background at Bell South, she was a natural fit for us, Phillips says. Now Holmes believes she's able to use her management skills to represent North Carolina's interests before the U.S. Department of Labor, which funds about 95% of the ESC's annual budget. In early 2009, North Carolina's trust fund used to pay out unemployment benefits dried up. Since then, the state has been dependent on federal loans, which as of July has grown to $2.4 billion. Those loans are continuing because the state doesn't have the finance to cover all the claims. And there are plenty of late. The workload over the last couple of years has been tremendous, Holmes says, estimating that the agency's remote service centers in Raleigh and in Charlotte get between 300 and 500 calls a day. That's in addition to the hundreds of one-on-one interactions at 89 ESC offices across the state. The agency's workforce has grown from about 1,500 employees 2 years ago to more than 2,200 employees and contractors paid mostly through federal grants and appropriations. We are one of the agencies that tends to grow when unemployment is up, Holmes says. I don't think anybody could have anticipated the sheer volume that this agency has had to deal with these last couple of years. In addition to management of unemployment benefits, the ESC is charged with helping workers find new jobs. In July, it referred 62,420 people to open positions and still had 19,344 job listings. The agency's third leg of business is the collection of labor data on behalf of the U.S. Department of Labor. Holmes has started discussions about how the agency will need to change its business model for the future to avoid the magnitude of losses it has experienced in the past year. Does the agency still need 89 offices? Should it become more self-service? Near the top of her agenda is a plan to improve the agency's computer infrastructure, which hasn't been overhauled since the 1980s. Holmes, the first African-American woman to head the agency, notes that the ESC chairman's hands are largely tied when it comes to big spending decisions because most of the funding comes from the U.S. Department of Labor. Nonetheless, she says she'll follow the governor's lead on discussions of how the state can repay the federal loan for unemployment benefits. That's an issue that 30-plus states around the country are having to begin to look at, Holmes says. Next up, strategic defaults, not part of Triangle Landscape yet, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. Desperate times for some real estate owners call for desperate measures when negotiations with a lender reach an impasse on a commercial building that's worth less than the loan. The Triangle commercial real estate market has so far seen few, if any, so-called strategic defaults. That's when an owner of a well-capitalized property opts to walk away from the investment and hand the keys over to the lender because the property's value has fallen far below the mortgage balance. But that doesn't mean that the owners of the local buildings aren't considering it as an option. Owners are wringing their hands. They don't know what to do, says David Warren, a partner from the Poynier and Spruill law firm who specialize in working with creditors and as a bankruptcy trustee. There's only so much the banks can do to rewrite the loan, and at a point you can't do anything else. Owners of the most troubled properties in the Triangle can link their problems to high vacancy rates, lower than expected cash flow, or to a pending maturity date for a loan, rather than to significant devaluation of the property due to national economic conditions. Commercial real estate appraiser Richard Kirkland of Apex says that the values of most commercial buildings he's researched recently have held over the past couple of years. But, he says, appraisals increasingly are depending on a property's cash flow rather than comparables. A lot of brokers are relying solely on that capitalization rate, he says. If a property has a high vacancy, I'd be more concerned about a drop in its value. Local dynamics have not been great, but they aren't devastating either, he says. On a national level, owners of expensive properties in Las Vegas, New York, and Los Angeles have seen property values plummet so fast that many see no other way to recoup their losses other than defaulting on their loans. Taubman Centers, Incorporated, for example, decided to stop covering interest payments on its $130 million mortgage on a major Atlantic City shopping center that it estimates is worth only $52 million now. About $1.4 trillion of commercial real estate debt is scheduled to come due by the end of 2014, and an estimated 52% of the property owners are underwater with their loans, according to commercial mortgage data company TREP, LLC. But strategic defaults can be tricky, says Frank Quinn, executive vice president of Anthony & Company in Raleigh. If an owner of a property decides to default on a loan with one of his limited liability corporations, he may still have outstanding loans on other properties with the same bank and could jeopardize the relationship. They have to weigh their options, Quinn says. While strategic defaults have become more common among residential real estate owners who risk damaging their personal credit as well as losing their home, most commercial loans are set up as non-recourse loans. The biggest penalty for an owner deciding to walk away from the property is the forfeiture of assets and the cash flow they generate. Next up, Solil owners told to pay Hunter Roberts. Building contractor wins $1 million judgment, but Crabtree Valley site may go into foreclosure, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh, a Wake County judge has put to rest a nearly two-year dispute between the owners of the Solil Center site at Crabtree Valley in Raleigh and the contractor hired to build the proposed tower. But the judgment in favor of the Hunter Roberts Construction Group may only be a hollow victory because the property could be nearing foreclosure, sources say. Hunter Roberts filed a lawsuit in October 2008 against the partners of Glentree Investments, LLC, claiming it was owed $918,320 for the work it had completed on the building's foundation. A judge on August 16th ruled in favor of Hunter Roberts and ordered Glentree to pay the full amount, plus interest, according to court documents. Glentree had no lawyer working on its behalf after counselors from two different firms were dismissed during the course of the case. Unfortunately for my client, the bank may end up taking the property back if they haven't already, says Kenny Lautenschlager, lawyer representing Hunter Roberts and a partner with the Johnston, Allison, and Hoard law firm in Charlotte. My client is left with that debt and is nowhere to collect. Glentree is a shell now. Glentree and its loan guarantors, Sanjay Mundra, Dickie Walia, and Rita Walia, have a $6.2 million outstanding loan with Regions Bank related to the Solil Center. The loan has been modified nine times since June 2005 to adjust its terms and maturity date, according to Wake County deed records. As of September 1st, no trustee or foreclosure documents have been filed in Wake County related to Glentree's investments. A lawsuit by the Perkins & Will architecture firm against Glentree is pending in Mecklenburg Court. Perkins & Will claims it is owed $336,572 for design work completed for the Solil Center project. Rod O'Donohue, former general counsel for Glentree Investments and its sister company, Solil Group of Cary, says he is no longer representing the companies. Solil Group partners Sanjay Mundra and Dickie Walia did not return calls for comment, and they have given no indication of when or if construction of Solil Center might resume. The proposed $170 million project was to include a luxury Westin hotel and 54 spacious condominium units on an 8-acre site near Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh. Hunter Roberts and its subcontractors spent months digging and drilling 120 concrete shafts that would serve as the foundation for the 480-foot-tall building. Construction work on the 43-story-tall Soleil Center project was halted in the summer of 2008 before it could even rise above ground level. A fence surrounds the site at the southwest corner of Glenwood Avenue and Creedmoor Road, but the construction cranes and the other equipment are gone. Soleil Center was considered one of the first victims of the bank credit crunch that ushered in a national recession and halted most real estate projects that were not already underway. Soleil Group's SkySail Condominiums project in New Bern also is in financial trouble after having to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in November. Additionally, the group is in litigation against the construction contractor for the project, Weaver Cook Construction, and several of its subcontractors. John Northern, with the Northern Blue Law Firm in Chapel Hill, is representing New Bern Riverfront Development, LLC, the entity that owns SkySail, in federal court, but Northern's co-counsel in the litigation case, Donald Eglinton of the Ward & Smith Law Firm, has requested to withdraw as counsel on the case. Eglinton stated in court documents that New Bern Riverfront Development failed to fulfill its contractual obligations documented in its litigation agreement. At the time of the bankruptcy filing, SkySail reported $31.5 million in assets and $25.6 million in liabilities. Soleil's partners are owners of the newly renovated Hilton New Bern Riverfront Hotel and the new New Bern Grand Marina, as well as multiple hotel properties across North Carolina. And now news from a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Keeping Seniors at Home by Todd Cohen. Among the 158 health and human services programs it funds at its 85 partner agencies, United Way of the Greater Triangle supports programs geared to helping senior citizens live in their own homes. Last year, those efforts helped 20,000 senior citizens maintain their living independence. Those seniors were among one in four people in Wake, Durham, Orange, and Johnston counties that receive a United Way service during the year. An investment in the United Way produces results, and we've seen a lot of good results that our agencies are getting, says Craig Chancellor, United Way President and CEO. United Way will focus its results during its annual fund drive this year. Chaired by Victoria Haynes, President and CEO of RTI International, the effort aims to raise $17.5 million, up from the $17.02 million it raised last year, when it fell short $280,000 short of its goal. The higher goal aims to provide funds United Way's partner agencies will need to meet an increase of roughly 30% in demand for services. To cope with that rising demand, Chancellor says, many agencies have reduced their staffing and tried to keep their budgets and salaries flat. All the cost savings measures you have to put in place in this economy, he says, they've been doing that. United Way itself has reduced its staff positions to 38, limited salary increases to 2.5% for each of the past 2 years, and kept its annual operating budget flat at just over $4 million. This year, based on the funds it raised in last year's drive, United Way allocated $6.8 million for its partner agencies, plus $8.5 million to other agencies designated by donors. To meet the goal for this year's drive, United Way aims to increase leadership gifts of $1,200 or more, which last year totaled $4.6 million, and corporate gifts, which last year totaled $3.6 million, by 5% each, and to increase by 5% points overall participation in the drive, which last year included 36,000 donors, or 18% of the people asked to give. It also aims to increase electronic giving, including online giving and social media giving, to $100,000 from $42,000 last year, and to raise funds through the Old Reliable Run on November 14th, an event that last year raised $85,000. Chancellor says United Way works to hold its partner agencies accountable for the funds they receive from the donors to the annual drive. To become a United Way partner, agencies must go through a certification process to assure us the agency is well run and managed well financially, he says. And to receive United Way funds, agencies must meet specific outcomes in their programs. It goes beyond numbers served, Chancellor says. It's about the positive impact they have on people's lives. For after-school programs that aim to help youth improve their grades in school, for example, the improvements students actually show. People who invest in United Way are having a positive impact on people's lives, says Chancellor, and by extension, on the community. From Around Town by Chris Basden. Hard work a given if fame to be achieved. From Raleigh. Do you want to live forever? Do you want to learn how to fly? Do you want people to remember your name? The North Carolina Theater Conservatory is here to help. Welcome to Raleigh's very own version of the performing arts school in the movie Fame. While not a high school, as in the famous movie, which recently was remade, the conservatory has a similar purpose: to provide technical instruction to students interested in careers in showbiz, and to those who just love to show off. Any student who's ever been interested in acting, singing, and dancing, there's a home for them here, says Heather Patterson King, an acting instructor who also is the director of outreach for the school. The conservatory, which is a function of the nonprofit North Carolina Theater, has been operating for 6 years now. More than 300 students currently are enrolled in classes, which primarily are aimed at kids between the ages of 5 and 18. Lower-level classes are open to all children whose parents are willing to pay the tab. A one-hour class for 15 weeks costs $350, though some upper-level instruction does require tryouts. The conservatory employs 10 instructors. Notable alumni include Broadway actor John Arthur Green and Jenny Gulley, who was part of a national tour of the stage production Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Students like the fact that instructors are serious about teaching a craft, but the lessons are not pressure-packed. It's also a place to meet others with similar interest. I do it because I love it, says Connor Lillis, a 17-year-old senior at Enloe High School, who spends 10 to 20 hours a week in conservatory classes. The conservatory is a place where you can express yourself and have a good time and meet awesome friends. Former Broadway actor Ray Walker, a Vermont native, started the program and now serves as its artistic director. In addition to professional preparation, he thinks the classes teach valuable life skills, such as building confidence and self-esteem. Walker knows that becoming a professional actor means traveling down a long, hard road with no guarantees of success. He tries to be realistic, but not jaded, when giving students feedback on their chances. For the kids that really want it, there has to be no other option, he says. It's a hard life. You've got to be prepared. But no matter how grand a talent, the level of subjectivity involved in landing professional acting and performing jobs can be disheartening. If you want fair, you should go somewhere else, Walker says, of a career in entertainment. When looking at such long odds, it's nice to have youth and enthusiasm on your side. Katie Bottomley, a 17-year-old senior at Athens Drive High School, has both. She's been attending the conservatory for a couple of years and hopes to one day perform in Broadway shows or write musicals. I'm there every single day that they're open, says Bottomley. There's never a day that I don't enjoy it. Next, from In the Workplace by Edward Marshall. To succeed, leaders must address lack of workplace trust. We hear it everywhere. People do not seem to trust large institutions, their leaders, or often others at work. The distrust gap is very significant, and its costs are significant. If there is distrust, we can lose customers. Or if our executive team members don't trust one another, they may be seriously misaligned on strategy. Or if our workforce distrusts leadership, there can be a loss of productivity, quality, and/or cost effectiveness. The costs are real, and if the distrust gap is not addressed as a core leadership challenge, business performance suffers. What is this gap? One way of thinking about it is to see it as the difference between our expected levels of trust of others and the behavior we actually experience of them, or that they experience of us. It is palpable in our work relationships and has a bottom-line quantitative value. The real question then is, how can we address this gap? Put the issue on the table. Distrust is usually the elephant in the room. It will take leadership courage to put it on the table in a way that is non-blaming and can actually lead to solutions. Denial, however, or sweeping it under the rug, merely widens the gap. Seek workforce input on the dimensions of trust. Quantitative data can be generated from the workforce that will enable leadership to have a serious dialogue about the subject. Start at the senior team level. Building high levels of trust starts at the top. If leadership can walk the walk, then trust levels will be strengthened across the board. If leaders consistently differ with each other from their silos, then the distrust gap widens. Common rules of engagement. A lot of distrust is generated because leaders play by different sets of rules. Having a common playbook, like how to make strategic decisions, that all leaders use reduces the distrust gap. Feedback is essential. Creating an ongoing, objective feedback loop among leaders on the senior team with direct reports and with the workforce provides a self-correcting mechanism that increases the possibility the gap will shrink. We can ignore the distrust gap and it can easily widen, or we can consciously choose to deal with it on an ongoing basis, for it is a journey and not a destination, an ongoing process and not an event. It's a journey worth exploring. The Economy Opens Up for Smaller Shops by Chris Basden from Raleigh. A few weeks ago, attorney Bill Janvier ended his tenure with the Raleigh-based law firm Everett Gaskins, which dissolved when the firm's partners decided to go their separate ways. Instead of seeking safe haven at a large or medium-sized law firm, Janvier hung his own shutter at a nearby location in downtown Raleigh. Now it's just Janvier and one associate on their own in a niche firm. With a dozen attorneys, Everett Gaskins wasn't a large enough firm by any means, but it did offer clients services in quite a few different practice areas. Given the uncertain economy, was it a good idea for Janvier to put all his eggs in one business basket? He thinks so, because his new firm is a boutique focused on bankruptcy law. He says mostly it's because of the nature of my practice, and he's worked as a triangle lawyer for 16 years. I'm in one of the few growth areas right now. Janvier's decision to go his own way likely will be part of a larger trend. Local legal insiders expect to see the number of specialty shops in the area grow in coming years due to both professional preference and economic stimuli. In particular, the cost-cutting at big firms has led to attorneys being laid off or new hires being delayed. Many of those lawyers and others who simply are tired of the bureaucracy and politics of large firms are likely to strike out on their own. Boutique firms generally concentrate on one area of the law and employ a handful of attorneys. Boutiques can be professionally rewarding because they give lawyers a chance to focus on a practice area that they enjoy the most, and they enjoy the work for themselves. I feel more energized to go into work every day than in a long time, says Janvier. I miss my former partners, but I love having my own shop. Despite their small size, boutiques can be lucrative for the attorneys working there, as long as the partners have an entrepreneurial inclination and good business sense. Karen Shanahan, who runs Shanahan Law Group, a Raleigh-based corporate and litigation shop with 9 attorneys, says a good boutique lawyer can absolutely make as much money as an attorney in a bigger firm. There's going to be an inherent limit in the big firm, he says. While not all specialty firms are seeing as much business as Janvier, many are still benefiting from the sorry state of the economy. That's because clients who typically procure services from big law firms, those with dozens or hundreds of lawyers spread across many practice areas, have been looking to cut costs as much as possible. So they've been pushing back on rates and, in some cases, taking their business elsewhere. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.